Welcome once again to Word on the Hills, with me, Felicity Sidnell-Reed, my co-host, Gwyn Shaltimer, and our guest this week, Ronald Mackay. Each week, we visit with a local author or other persons involved with writers and readers. We ask them to introduce us to their work. We hope for a glimpse into their lives to find out what prompts them to write, and we give them an opportunity to read to us. We're delighted to have a return visit this week from Ronald Mackay. Welcome, Ronald.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Ronald Mackay was born in Scotland. After leaving school, he travelled and worked in Spain and the Canary Islands for 2 years. He completed an MA at Aberdeen University, paying for his studies by serving in the 3rd Battalion Territorial Gordon Highlanders and working vacations in London as a postman, skin grader with the Hudson's Bay Company and Bricky's labourer. Upon graduating, he was appointed to teach phonetics at Bucharest University, Romania. After leaving Romania, Ronald pursued problem-solving as a career until the early 90s, when he became a university professor of applied linguistics. In 2012, he retired, and he and his wife returned to Canada. Ronald and Viviana, who is Peruvian, live in the home they built in 2009 on the shores of Rice Lake near Keene, Ontario. He has 2 stepdaughters and 4 grandchildren. He's just published a new memoir, Fortunate Isle, and is here to tell us about it. So, Ronald, your new memoir takes you back almost 50 years to the year 1960, when you were 18 and had just left school in Scotland. How are you able to recall people and incidents, landscape and weather from such a long time ago?
The short answer, Felicity, is very easily. I wrote the manuscript in the comfort of my wife's family home in Lima, Peru, where I don't have all the tasks to do that I have while I'm in Canada. I don't cook, I don't clean, I don't do the washing, I don't iron. All I do is the daily shopping. And so I can devote myself entirely from morning until night, as many sessions as I want, to sit down. And as soon as I sit down, this happened with the first memoir as well, the ideas come to me, the memories come to me, the people come to me, and the words come to me. It's not as if I'm composing, it's actually as if I'm remembering.
Mm-hmm. So where did you get the confidence to travel at 18 with the minimum of money to such a distant place as the island of Tenerife?
I'd have to say that my mother gave myself and my younger brother and my elder sister the confidence from our very earliest age. As far back as I can remember, I can hear her saying frequently, "I can't leave you money, but I'll give you standards to live by, I'll give you healthy good food and a good education, and I'll make you self-reliant." And by the time we were in our early teens, there was virtually nothing that we couldn't do, and so taking off for a year or 2 years and traveling as far as the Canary Islands, hoping to get to South America, wasn't something that I found particularly surprising.
Just surprising to others. I guess your mother believed in it. So what did it feel like to settle for close on a year in a tiny 16th century village in a small group of islands in the Atlantic Ocean, a place where you didn't even speak the language and had no right to settle, let alone work?
That's true. Actually, it felt like coming home. The village was a very ancient village, and its way of life hadn't changed for decades, possibly even centuries. Its inhabitants were comfortable with one another. Everybody knew everybody else. The village was no more than 2,500 souls, even including the small farms around in the countryside. Some were better off than others, but there was no jealousy, there was no rancor, there was no envy, no resentment. People accepted their lives and lived their lives comfortably, happily, with each other and with their families. And so, as the only outsider in that village, I was welcomed so long as I played by the village rules, which I learned quite early. One of the chapters in the books explains that I was taken aside one day and explained how to conduct myself on Sunday afternoon walks in the square when the young men and young women walked around the square. But I found it very easy and very comfortable to live in that village and learn the language very quickly. I had to work, and so I had to master the language immediately.
So if I were to ask you what Fortunate Isle is about, and you were to answer in one sentence or so, what would you say?
The one sentence answer would be that it's about the adventures of a young 18-year-old Scotsman who takes off for somewhat over a year and lives in this island and works in this island entirely independently, making his own money for a year. These adventures. But while I was writing the book, I realized that it was more than that. On that other level that I discovered when I was writing, I discovered it was about a young man who overcomes feelings of disorientation as a result of his parents' unhappy family life. He overcomes feelings of resentment for having failed to gain entry into Aberdeen University to study agriculture. University entry was very competitive in those days. And he overcomes feelings of suspicion bred by having been dragged from his first comfortable home in the country with his grandmother during the Second World War to a large city still in Scotland, but whose dialect was completely different from the one that he'd learned from the time he was a baby. And in Buena Vista del Norte, he comes to rest in harmony with the village, with the people in the village, and he learns that the world is indeed a fit place to live in. And it's about the redemptive role that friendships play in our lives. That's the long version.
Yes. So, did you feel you were accepted in the community? Because it obviously was a community there.
Yes. I was initially looked on with a little bit of suspicion because since the end of the Spanish Civil War, Spain had been virtually cut off from the rest of Europe. So I did have a run-in quite early with the civil guard and with the village judge. But since I wasn't doing anything wrong and they couldn't find that I was doing anything wrong, they left me alone. And so it was up to me to adapt myself to the mores and the habits and the way of interacting in the village, which I did very successfully once I mastered the language.
Right. So I know, in fact, that you've also written several plays, but why have you now chosen memoirs your preferred genre?
I actually started off wanting to write radio plays for the BBC.
Yeah.
I listened to BBC radio plays all my life and love them. When I was rather unsuccessful in my early attempts, I met a group of actors and playwrights in Peterborough, Ontario, and so I switched to writing for the stage and have had some modest success there. I came to memoir writing not so much as a primordial desire, but through the urgings of Viviana, my wife, who had suggested many times that I should write about my life, and also through a workshop that I took with Diane Taylor, a one-day workshop, which inspired me to think about what part of my life or what parts of my life might be worth writing about. And so I really came to memoir writing by accident. And I'm not sure if I'm stuck here or if I'm going on to other things.
Right. Well, please read to us now from Fortunate Isle.
The background to the first reading is that during my first few weeks living in the village inn in Buena Vista del Norte, my difficulty with Spanish intrigued the innkeeper's grandchildren. They called me el extranjero, the foreigner. And one day I was challenged by Kaya, a 9-year-old, and her cousins. Kaya says, "Candelita is only 3. She can recite in Spanish. Why can't you speak Spanish since you're so much older. Kaya's nine-year-old logic is impeccable. I pause, attempting to cobble together a credible defense. In Spanish, the word for language is lengua. Lengua also means tongue. In my country, Kaya, we use a different lengua, a different language, I begin. You use a different tongue? I have the undivided attention of five pairs of eyes. Yes, my first tongue is inglés. When I learn it, Spanish will be my second tongue. The extranjero has one tongue already, and his second tongue will be Spanish. Kaya, wide-eyed, makes the announcement. She holds up two fingers, points to my mouth. A second tongue? The children look from one to the other, impressed, then wander off to play. A few short weeks after that incident, I was making great progress with the language. One evening, I came back from work and hear childish laughter coming from my room, which stood permanently open. All five children are going through the many pockets of my well-worn ex-army rucksack. They freeze instantly, alarm on their faces. Hola, I greet. Their eyes are downcast in guilty silence. What are you up to? Nothing. Are you looking for something? I try to sound reassuring. It's evident from the children's uneasy silence that I'm not going to get an answer. So I pick up my rucksack off the floor. What would you like to see? I possess nothing at all of value except my passport and a camera I can only use occasionally because the cost of film is so exorbitant. But my question brings a tiny quiver to Candelita's lower lip, and I realize that I must be careful to avoid tears. Don't worry, I'm not angry, just curious. Relief floods their faces. I've already shown you everything I have, but if you like, I'll show it to you again. I offer a smile. They stand in line, silent, the younger children eyeing their nine-year-old leader. They're willing her to speak. Kaya's young face takes on an almost adult seriousness. Do you remember that day you told us that you were going to get Spanish to be your second tongue? I nod. My grandmother says that you've now acquired that second tongue. She pauses. I'm trying to follow her gist. I smile encouragement. Well, now that you've got your second tongue, we're searching everywhere to find out where you keep your first one. Four little heads nod in sober agreement, eyes bright with contrition now that they've been assured my forgiveness. We only want to look at it. Fonfon's eyes are enormously large. We want to see what your first tongue looks like. Candelita's face glows with anticipation. Kaya, at nine, is already more pragmatic. You won't tell Mama, will you? First things first. Their idea of what it takes to be bilingual leaves me in awe. Substitute tongues that can be slipped into place with a simple click to meet the linguistic demands of the moment. Oh, that it were so easy. But how to reveal to young minds that the fix doesn't lie with replaceable anatomy? I'm lost for words to explain how the single Spanish word lengua serves two completely different purposes. One refers to the system of sounds and words we use to communicate with family and friends, the other to the pliable muscle we mold, point, curve, and flex to create the sounds that express what we feel and allow others to understand us. Of course I'm not going to tell your mamas. It's all I can think to say. For now, it's all they want to hear. Off they troop with grateful looks, but without the understanding I would like to have shared with them. Their years are too tender to disappoint them with stark facts about how demanding some of life's many challenges will turn out to be.
That's a lovely incident. And what a good idea to have.
I thought so too.
Replaceable tongue. I'd like one of those. So thank you very much, Ronald. Now we'll take a short break.